All right, our final case today is number 19-12227, Smile Direct Club, LLC versus Battle. And Mr. Pinson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. This is Andrew Pinson for the members of the Georgia Board of Dentistry. The state action doctrine says that the states have the prerogative as sovereigns to decide how best to promote public health and welfare without the specter of federal antitrust scrutiny. That doctrine protects the orthodontic scan rule that was challenged in this case based on what should be an uncontroversial conclusion. When the governor of Georgia, the state's chief executive and most politically accountable public official, decides to put a dentistry regulation into effect, that's an exercise of the state's sovereign authority.
Before you get to the merits, Mr. Pinson, can I ask you a jurisdictional question?
Yes.
Is it right, and it's in two parts, so here's the first part. Is it right to call Parker state action antitrust immunity a real immunity, or just simply a decision about how far the Sherman Act reaches? It's not 11th Amendment type immunity. It's not qualified or absolute immunity. It's about how far the Sherman Act goes. Is that an accurate characterization or not?
Your Honor, I think it's both. It's absolutely a determination by the Supreme Court that the Sherman Act does not reach the regulatory conduct of the states themselves, but it's also a doctrine grounded in respect for state sovereignty, and that respect for state sovereignty, I think, warrants treating it like an immunity from suit, in large part because the effect of not providing that protection is to subject the state and its officials, and in this case, indeed, the governor himself, to antitrust scrutiny. So I think you could treat it as both.
I'll take that answer as you framed it, and so I'll assume that it is partly immunity based. If that's the case, there are two circuits, including one which allows interlocutory appeals of Parker state action immunity claims, which have held that you don't allow an interlocutory appeal when there are private market participants who are the ones trying to appeal. And that's the Fifth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit. So tell me why we should deviate from that case law and allow the members of the board to take an interlocutory appeal.
Couple of responses. First of all, the members of the board are not private actors. As the district court below recognized, they indeed are state actors for purposes of 11th Amendment immunity. So treating the state board as the same as purely private actors doesn't make sense.
Well, not the board, the board members. They couldn't sue the board, right? They couldn't sue the board because the board is an agency or an arm of the state, and therefore you can't sue under the 11th Amendment and sovereign immunity. They sued the board members, and the board members are not government officials in their normal capacities, right? They're private market participants.
They're still challenging the actions of the board members in promulgating this rule. That gets them around 11th Amendment immunity.
Sure, through an ex parte Young theory, but it doesn't take away from the fact that the board members are not, in their day jobs, the board members are not government officials. They are private market participants. And again, why should we create a circuit split and go away from the Fifth and Tenth Circuits and allow them to take up an interlocutory appeal?
Well, that gets to my second point, which is that even putting aside that we think that the board members, even in their individual capacities, are different from purely private participants, this circuit has already allowed interlocutory appeals in at least two cases of private market participants. I think TEC code generation is one. The other is escaping me at the moment, but both of those were
members of PROXIRE. Yes.
But in those cases, was the interlocutory appeal jurisdictional issue addressed?
I can't recall off the top of my head, but I do know that it was certainly in both cases they were granted interlocutory appeals under the collateral order doctrine. And I do believe in those
cases. Wasn't one of them a 1292B appeal?
No, as we point out in our briefing, both of them recognize that for the relevant appellees that the appeal was under the collateral order doctrine. I believe that's in a footnote in our brief. I can find that for you on rebuttal if you'd like. I do want, unless there are further questions about jurisdiction, I would like to move to the merits. So we have two standards under which it's our view that the board that the orthodontic scan rule is state action. The first is that it automatically qualifies as state action because the governor himself, a sovereign actor, put it into effect. The parties in this case barely dispute the initial premise that the governor is a sovereign actor. However narrow that category it is, the chief executive of a state and someone with direct statewide political accountability is someone who would be a sovereign actor whose actions would automatically qualify as state action. So the question is this orthodontic scan rule attributable to the governor? Under Hoover versus Ronwin, the U.S. Supreme Court case, we think that this case is directly analogous.
Did you raise this governor argument below?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the board members' very first argument in their motion to dismiss with respect to the state action doctrine was that ipso facto immunity applies because of the governor's conduct in approving the rule. We elaborated on this argument in reply and then again raised it at the hearing. So it's plainly preserved.
This is Judge Anderson. This is Judge Anderson talking. I actually do not believe you did raise this. You did raise an ipso facto argument in the district court, but that argument was the arm of the state argument. In other words, it was an argument that the board is an agency of the state, an instrumentality of the state. I looked very carefully at your brief to the district court, and you did not argue that you were ipso facto immune because the governor himself took it upon his review was so complete and so substantial that he, in effect, made the rule an act of the governor as opposed to an act of the board. With respect to which he just reviewed.
Your Honor, I have a couple of citations that I can point you to. One is docket number 29-1 at 37. That's the board member's motion to dismiss. And I'll quote, ipso facto immunity applies here. As an initial matter, the action at issue in this case, the rule was explicitly approved by Georgia's governor. And then we cite a case that provides for ipso facto immunity. If you look at the reply, document number 34 at 19 through 20, we expand on that argument. And then in the hearing on the motion to dismiss, that's docket number 49 at 28, we raise the argument there as well.
Do you distinguish between the arm of the state instrumentality argument and the attribution to the governor?
Yes, I believe we do. We certainly make those arguments under the heading of state action immunity and not with respect to the instrumentality. And our citation in the
instrumentality arm of the state is also state action immunity. We will look at that carefully. I have real doubt that you raised it, but we will look at it very carefully.
All right, and so I'm happy to provide more on that. But moving on to the attribution point, I would say under Hoover, we think that there is a clear analogy to this case, and the key point in Hoover is ultimate authority over the relevant action. On 12 separate occasions, the court in that case says the Arizona Supreme Court made the ultimate decision to approve the grading formula.
Judge Anderson again, and I have a question on the merits of your ipso facto immunity argument. You make a very persuasive argument that the Georgia legislation may well give the governor the authority and the power to review substantively so sufficiently as to make the rule the act of the governor himself. But the governor's certification in this case very clearly does not do that. It very clearly ascertains, it says the governor ascertained that the rule was within the authority that was delegated to the board, and therefore the governor approved it. It seems to me, and it seems to me that ipso facto immunity should apply only if it is actually in reality the rule of the governor, not and it's not enough if he merely had the potential but did not in fact so act.
Your Honor, I think he did in fact so act, and that's for a couple of reasons. First, the PRRA itself says the governor is the one who must approve this rule, and he must do that after reviewing it.
That doesn't satisfy me, because that is mere potential.
Well, so second, if you look to the certificate itself, I think the governor does more than just say it's within the board's authority. He cites the clearly articulated policy at issue, which is to promote the public health and welfare through the regulation of dentistry. And then he says the amendment is within the board's authority as granted by clearly articulated state policy. So he's doing his job, complying with that statute and exercising his authority and duty under that statute to approve the rule. It's the approval itself that we think is the critical point, because that's what's under Hoover is enough. I would say, of course, we also have an independent basis under MidCal for reaching the same result here, and that's that the orthodontic scan rule is state action under both prongs of MidCal. So unless there are further questions about ipso facto, I'm happy to turn to that quickly.
Judge Choflat, you're familiar with the Article 3 principle that we do not decide issues provisionally.
Yes, sir.
The district judge said that a definitive ruling on Parker immunity would be premature at this stage. So however we decide this case on the merits, for or against you, the issue is still going to be entertained in the district court, because we would have made a decision based only on what we have here and not based on what the district court's record ultimately shows on the issue. And Article 3 just doesn't allow us to do that, I don't believe.
Your Honor,
It's a hypothetical ruling, in other words.
Your Honor, I don't think it's a hypothetical
in the sense that we're making a ruling on what you presented, but the real ruling has not yet been made down there to the district court, so it's just hypothetical. we'd be, I guess, be sending the district judge some kind of a message, but it wouldn't be binding. There'd be no mandate rule enforced here.
Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think it would be no more hypothetical than any other decision reviewing a denial of a motion to dismiss. The only sense in which the district court's decision is tentative is that that they still have to prove on summary judgment their claim that there's no active supervision here. But it is certainly a definitive legal ruling that
it would be a ruling on what you presented to us now and not what the district judge ultimately might decide. That's my problem.
Your Honor, if this court were to decide that as a matter of law, state action immunity applies, it would not be an advisory ruling to the district court. The antitrust claim would be dismissed. That would be the end of the matter. There wouldn't be any further discovery on the question. The case only goes forward if they stated a claim, stated an antitrust claim, including stating a claim that state action immunity does not apply. I see that I've gone past my time. I'm happy to continue to talk through the active supervision or reserve for rebuttal.
No, we'll give you your time for rebuttal, Mr. Pinton. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Cashton.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Cashton of King & Spalding. I represent the plaintiff appellee, Smile Direct Club. I will turn in a moment to the jurisdictional questions that both Judge Jordan and Judge Chofa have raised because they're important. But what I want to note is that the U.S. Supreme Court held in the Dental Examiner's case that, quote, a state board on which a controlling number of decision makers are active market participants in the occupation the board regulates must satisfy MidCal's active supervision requirement in order to invoke state action antitrust immunity, quote. And the district court in this case properly recognized that Dental Examiners is controlling here. The board member's principal argument on appeal effectively asks this court to read out of existence the Supreme Court's clear holding in Dental Examiners. In that decision, the Supreme Court explained that while adequacy of supervision will depend on all the circumstances of a case, there are, quote, a few constant requirements of active supervision, end quote, all of which are necessary and none of which alone are sufficient to show active supervision. In this case, the board members point to one of those constant requirements identified by the court, the state's power to veto or approve particular decisions of the board. And they argue that when the governor exercises this supervisory power, the restraint should then no longer be attributed to the board members, but rather to the board, and MidCal should no longer apply. Applying this attribution fiction that the board members suggest would undo the holding of the Supreme Court. By merely assigning a state actor the power to veto or modify a restraint, as is required for active supervision, the requirement for active supervision would be eliminated. And that argument is simply too clever by half. The truth is that the active supervision requirement applies here, and the board members cannot satisfy it at the motion to dismiss stage. The Supreme Court in Dental Examiners explained that to meet the active supervision requirement, the state supervisor, quote, must review the substance of the anti-competitive decision, not merely the procedures followed to produce it. Here on its face, the governor's certification of active supervision confirms that the governor focused solely on the board's purported authority to pass the challenged rule and not at all on the substance of the anti-competitive decision or the specifics of the state's economic policy, subjects the Supreme Court has explained must be considered as part of effective active supervision. As such, the district court properly rejected the board member's motion to dismiss. Now, I'd like to pick up, Judge Chofot, on your question. I think it's an important one. The Supreme Court and this court have explained that the scope of the collateral order doctrine is modest, and courts must insist on strict compliance with the doctrine's requirements. As this court has explained, even in cases involving a class of issues where immediate appeal may be permitted under the document, such as immunity decisions, where the order at issue does not conclusively determine the disputed question because of the need for further factual development, an intermediate appeal is not permitted under the collateral order doctrine. As the Supreme Court said itself in Cohen, quote, so long as the matter remains open, unfinished, or inconclusive, there may be no intrusion by appeal. The Supreme Court's decision in Swint v. Chambers, which affirmed this issue with regard to how this court approached it, is really on point. In that case, the Supreme Court unanimously held that a preliminary ruling on a summary judgment motion for qualified immunity did not qualify for interlocutory appeal under the collateral order doctrine. As the Supreme Court explained in that case, quote, the district court planned to reconsider its ruling on the county commission's summary judgment motion based on qualified immunity before the case went to the jury, end quote. The court thus held that the ruling fails the Cohen test, which disallows appeal from any decision which is tentative, informal, or incomplete. Now, it would be hard to imagine a circumstance where the district court was more clear than in this case that his decision was not conclusive. The district court expressly stated in the motion to dismiss order below that, quote, a definitive ruling on Parker immunity would be premature at this stage, end quote.
How is that any different than any ruling on the face of a complaint for immunity purposes?
It's different, Your Honor, because in this case what the court said is that further factual development is required. The court wasn't saying that as a matter of law the defendant's motion was denied. He was saying he specifically said, Your Honor, further factual development is required to determine whether the board members are entitled to Parker immunity. And that's
But in doing that, isn't he saying that as a matter of law, on the face of the complaint, there's no dismissal for Parker state immunity?
Now, the difference here, Your Honor, is that it would be different if it was a case where he was holding that under no set of facts would they be entitled to the immunity claim, and therefore it's a pure legal issue.
It is a pure legal issue because he's looking at the face of your complaint and looking to see whether or not, as a matter of law, Parker state action immunity bars your complaint. And the ruling is that at the motion to dismiss stage, it does not. And so the other side's argument is, as a matter of law, it does. How is that any different than denying immunity in any other sort of scenario on a 12b6 motion?
Well, the issue that this court has identified, and it comes right out of commuter transportation systems, is that the question you're trying to determine is, has the court finally and conclusively determined the defendant's claim of right not to stand trial on the plaintiff's allegations? In this case, what the district court has said is, I haven't conclusively decided that fact. There's a contest over whether there was a sufficient active supervision. I've looked at the allegations. They make me think that there is a real issue here about that claim. I want to see what discovery has to provide. I will give the defendants a chance to avoid the right standing trial at a later date. And that's exactly what this court in commuter transportation held is necessary to have a situation where you can have a collateral order review. But where the right to stand trial is not conclusively determined, it's the antithesis of interlocutory appeal under Cohen.
This is Judge Anderson. I've got a couple of questions. First,
yes, Your Honor.
You are jumping from Judge Joflat's Article 3 concern to collateral order immediate appeal. So I want to address that first. With respect to that, that it may be that we should follow the other circuits, the 5th and 10th, I think, instead of ours, but have we not held pretty flatly in diverse power that this very question of state action immunity is immunity from suit, not just immunity from liability, and that there is collateral order appeal? I realize that there was also a 1292B there, And the same thing was true in Proxair. There was a 1292B, but in both cases, the court expressly held that it was appealable under the collateral order doctrine. How do we get around our prior panel?
Your Honor, I think, that, as I view it, and as we briefed it, I think that those are two different issues. The first issue is, does a ruling under the state action defense, as I call it, immunity as the court calls it, is a ruling under that Parker doctrine immediately appealable under generally under the collateral order doctrine? This circuit has answered the question, yes, it is, and I do not think that this panel has the ability to overrule another panel on that issue. We've simply asked, suggested that it might be appropriate for the en banc court to consider it. There's one nuance to that, which Judge Jordan picked up on, which is that this court has not directly ruled on whether that same logic should apply where you have a private or an entity treated as private actor, and where the court has identified that there's greater risk. But generally speaking, you're right that that class of cases this court has held, they are immediately appealable under the collateral order doctrine. But the other issue that I was talking about, which I think Judge Choflat's question went to...
Well, before you get there, to piggyback on Judge Anderson's question, don't our decisions in Proxair and TEC cogeneration involve private market participants trying to get an interlocutory appeal and get Parker state action immunity?
Both of those cases do involve private market participants. In TEC, the court observed that it had, quote, dual jurisdiction, and therefore did not need to address the issue of whether it would have been appropriate for collateral order jurisdiction to apply. What the court held and said in TEC was that it already had jurisdiction as well under 1292B. In Praxair, the court noted that most of the case was there on a 1292B, did note that the Florida Power and Florida Power and Light had appealed based on the collateral order doctrine, and the court noted that fact and noted that there was did not discuss whether that was appropriate. So I think that the hardest one would be Proxair.
Judge Anderson, on Proxair, I am going to read you the page number. It's page 611, and it says there. It says we vacate the previous order and grant 1292 jurisdiction to Proxair's appeal. There is collateral order appellate jurisdiction of the appeals of Florida Power and Florida Power and Light, citing Cohen.
Yes.
It seems to me that is a holding.
Yeah, I believe it is, Your Honor. And two sentences up from that, or three sentences up, the court says it is not necessary to discuss the jurisdictional issues. And so I agree with you that Praxair is the closest that the court comes to a holding in a case involving a private entity. I would note two things. Number one, I don't think that that issue was specifically addressed more than what you and I have just read. And second, that decision came down in 1995, prior to the time the Supreme Court articulated specifically in the dental examiner's case the heightened concern that we need to have when private actors are empowered to take what the state is calling state action. Recall that in dental examiners, the court talked about there's a structural risk that that active market participants will pursue their own interests instead of the state's policy goals.
I understand that. We do not ordinarily hold that a ruling like that, not squarely on point, abrogates a prior panel.
I agree, Your Honor, and in our brief, I don't think we suggest that a prior panel has been abrogated. But I do want to make the point, if I may, that I took Judge Choflat's question, and it's the first argument we argue in our brief to be a little bit different than what you suggested, Judge Anderson, which is that while this class of issues, state action immunity under Parker, may generally be directly appealable, the collateral order doctrine still applies, and you still have to make sure that the elements of the collateral order doctrine, all of the elements, have been satisfied. And in Swintz, for example, there's no question in this circuit that generally legal questions about qualified immunity are subject to immediate collateral order doctrine appeal. But in Swint, a qualified immunity appeal was not permitted because the decision was not final. It was not conclusive on the issue. And if there's no reason to think that that issue about conclusivity of the decision would apply to qualified immunity and sovereign immunity questions, but for some reason wouldn't apply to Parker immunity questions. And so here, when the district court has specifically reserved the issue for a final determination at some later date,
I understand your argument. Answer this question for me, though. If your opponent, the board members, are correct that the governor's mere potential to exercise sufficient supervision and review substantively so as to make the rule his own. So, for example, suppose the certification said, instead of what it in fact said, suppose it said, I have reviewed this carefully myself. I have considered it with, I've consulted the Attorney General. We have reviewed the rule to determine whether or not it is consistent with the state policy and so forth, to make it clear that the governor is making the rule his own. Their argument is that that is, that he doesn't have to do all that, that the mere power to do that, which the Georgia legislation clearly gives him the power, it seems to me, and the authority to do all of that, but he just didn't do it. And so there's a legal issue, it seems to me, and the legal issue is, well, it seems to me pretty clear, that the mere power, the mere potential to make the ruling, the governor's own ruling, is not enough. It has to be actually the ruling of the governor to be ipso facto immune. That is a legal issue that seems to me we've got to decide in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it's appropriate for the court to view the immediate appealability of the state action immunity issue as one that should come up and down and up and down from the district court piecemeal as the district court evaluates the different issues and prongs associated with state action immunity. And I would suggest that the proper course, the better course, and the course that's suggested by the Supreme Court precedent is that you wait for the district court to make a conclusive ruling prior to the time the right to avoid trial has been overcome. And that's what the district court indicated it would do here. I will note, Your Honor, that in order for this court to accept the argument that the mere power of the government to do what he's supposed to do in active supervision is sufficient, this court would need to overrule the Supreme Court's decision in both Board of Dental Examiners and TICOR. And finally, if I may, I would note that while the board members council likes to talk about the Hoover case on appeal here, you're absolutely right, Your Honor. The Hoover case was not cited a single time in the court below. In the court below, the argument was that because the governor had taken this action, the board itself was entitled to ipso facto immunity. And the analogy to Hoover is just completely misplaced, because in Hoover, the Supreme Court of Arizona had been given by the Arizona Constitution the power to regulate the practice of law. And the Arizona Supreme Court delegated its role to a committee, which it oversaw and ultimately had to confirm the committee's action. That's not what's happening here. Here, the Board of Dentistry has been established by the Georgia General Assembly, not by the governor. The Georgia Board of Dentistry is not undertaking any conduct, any rulemaking that's been delegated by the governor. It's the Board of Dentistry that's been delegated this authority directly by statute. All the governor is doing here is playing the active supervision role, which is expressly what the Georgia Professional Regulation Reform Act states. And in order to actively supervise, he has to look beyond what the board did and consider whether it is consistent with state economic policy in displacing competition. None of that happened. We factually allege reasons why it didn't happen. And we don't think that the board has met its burden here. And as a result, we think that the lower court's decision should be affirmed.
All right, Mr. Cashin, thank you very much. Mr. Mintz?
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, this is Stephen Mintz for the United States and the Federal Trade Commission, and I would like to elaborate on a few of the active supervision points that that Mr. Cashin discussed. The first being to respond to this notion that simply because the governor acting as a supervisor approves a board rule, that somehow transforms the rule into the act of the governor or makes it attributable to the governor. We don't think that is correct. The Supreme Court has said repeatedly that because the state action doctrine is disfavored, it has to be construed narrowly, but transforming every rule of a professional board into an act of the supervisor that approved the rule is hardly a narrow construction of state action. We also think that the board's argument is inconsistent with the Georgia statute, the PRRA. The PRRA only gives the governor the power to supervise. It does not make the governor a regulator, either of dental assistance or of or of anything else. It's a very limited delegation from the legislature to the governor to act as a supervisor in compliance with the dental examiner's decision. The whole first section of the Georgia bill that became the PRRA states very clearly that the purpose of the statute was to comply with the dental examiner's decision and to enable Georgia to do active supervision, not to evade active supervision, as the board suggests. The next point I would like to touch on is Hoover, which Mr. Cashin did, and I fully agree with him. We think Hoover is inapplicable because in that case, the bar committee really acted as the agent of the state Supreme Court, and we don't have anything like that happening here. Here, the board was not created by the governor, not controlled by the governor. The board's powers stem from the legislature, and so factually, Hoover is not a parallel case. I'd also like to respond to the board's argument that the governor should be treated as a sovereign for state action purposes. In our view, this case does not properly present that question, because as I just mentioned, the Georgia PRRA expressly defined the governor as a supervisor, not as a regulator. And we agree with the statement of the Fourth Circuit in the South Carolina State Board of Dentistry case. In a footnote, the Fourth Circuit said, well, the Supreme Court has reserved judgment on whether a governor can invoke ipso facto immunity, but the Supreme Court has suggested that the answer is no. And I'd like to give some reasons for why we think the answer should be no.
And the reason is, warning.
Yes, and the reason is that the Supreme Court has said repeatedly that the legislature and the state Supreme Court are sovereign when they act legislatively. So a state Supreme Court is not a sovereign, for example, when it acts judicially. Ordinarily, a governor does not act legislatively to make the law. Ordinarily, a governor enforces the law enacted by others, and that's executive power, not legislative power. A governor typically acts on delegated authority, not on inherent authority. Now, that said, there may be some specific situations in which a governor does act under inherent authority and therefore might be said to be acting as a sovereign, and I believe we gave an example on page 24 of our brief, but that's not this case. In this case, the governor did not act legislatively. He acted only on a delegated authority from the legislature, and that was only a very limited power to supervise. There was no action by the governor based on inherent authority. So even if the case, even if the issue was properly presented here, under the facts of this case, we do not think that the governor should be treated as a sovereign entity for state action purposes.
All right. Thank you very much for your help. Mr. Pinson, you've got your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try a lightning round on jurisdiction and then make a couple other points if I can. This same panel in Diverse Power reaffirmed that the denial of state action immunity is immediately appealable, even on a motion to dismiss. The Supreme Court in Mohawk, a 2009 case, well beyond Swint in 95, said this is not a case-by-case inquiry. You look at the class of cases. And this class of cases, this court has said over and over, is immediately appealable. Commuter Transportation says the issue is conclusively decided, the state action immunity issue, even if based on the existence of potential fact issues. And that was at summary judgment. So I think it applies with even stronger force here. Finally, you would not be deepening any circuit split with respect to private action or immediate appealability for private parties. To the extent there is one, it was already created by this court with respect to private for-profit companies. This isn't even that. So those are the points on jurisdiction. With respect to Judge Anderson's question about ipso facto not applying or not treating the rule of state action because the governor didn't take sufficient ownership of the rule, Hoover directly rejects that kind of argument. A similar argument was made in Hoover, and Hoover said it's not a question of the rigor of the sovereign actor's decision or whether they acted wisely after full disclosure from subordinates. The key question in Hoover over and over is whether the sovereign actor had ultimate authority to make the decision over the challenged action in the case. Similarly, the government points out that Hoover had that there was an agency relationship between the court and the committee in Hoover. Hoover didn't really care about that. Again, the ultimate authority was the relevant point. Similarly, the question about the governor here exercising some kind of supervisory authority instead of sovereign authority, first of all, that's not true. It's the governor's decision to put the rule into effect. Second, it's not a distinction. Hoover looked at the same thing. One of the things that it saw as determinative in that case was that the Arizona Supreme Court did have supervisory authority over the committee. And finally, the broader point there, I think, is the idea that a federal court would decide when a state governor does and does not act on behalf of the state for state sovereign for the purposes of the state action doctrine. I think sort of bleeds beyond its role in these cases. And I guess I would close with a hypothetical that I think helps maybe sharpen the point about the governor here. Consider the Georgia PRRA with the exact same rules, except instead of giving it to the governor, it gave it to the legislature for an up and down vote for every rule. If the legislature approved those rules and they're codified into law, there would be no question that those are state action, regardless of the breadth of that rule, regardless of the fact that it applies to all professional licensing. The only question here is whether a federal court is willing to give the same respect to the sovereign actor, the governor of a state, in enacting that rule. And so with that, if there are no further questions, we ask the court to reverse the district court.
All right. Thank you all very much for your arguments. We appreciate them. We are done with our slate of cases for today, and the court is in recess until tomorrow. Thank you very much.